First of all, isn't all that much blood during childbirth? Not much more than when you have your period. Second, you're not really a spectator at your delivery. You're a very active participant, putting every ounce of your concentration and energy into pushing your baby those last few inches. Caught up in the excitement and anticipation, and let's face it, the pain and fatigue, you're unlikely to notice, much less be unsettled by, any bleeding. If you ask friends who've given birth before, few will be able to tell you just how much blood, if any, there was at their deliveries. If you still feel strongly that you don't want to see any blood, simply keep your eyes off the mirror at the moment of birth, and look away too in the unlikely event that an episiotomy is performed. Instead, just look down past your belly for a good view of your baby as he or she emerges. From this vantage point, virtually no blood will be visible. But before you decide to opt out of watching your own delivery, watch someone else's by viewing a childbirth on YouTube. You'll probably be much more awestruck than horrified. Delaying cord clamping.
What's this I hear about not clamping the umbilical cord right away after the baby is born?
It's a part of the birth that used to go pretty much unnoticed in the birthing room, at least by parents who were too busy basking in the glow of baby's first moments, gazing into those just opening eyes, enjoying those first cuddles, counting fingers, toes, and blessings, to realize or care that the doctor had already clamped the umbilical cord within just a few moments of delivery. While midwives delivering babies in birthing centers and at home have long taken their time with umbilical cord clamping, it has traditionally been done in a flash in hospital settings, without fanfare, and certainly without delay. Wham, bam, clamp you, mom. The reason for this quick clamping? Because it was believed to reduce the risk of hemorrhaging, mom losing too much blood after delivery. But current research seems to show that faster may not be better, and that delayed cord clamping not only doesn't increase the risk of a mom hemorrhaging, but may offer real benefits to baby. A clamping delay after delivery allows the placenta to give a few more pulses of blood to the newborn, and this extra dose of blood can represent as much as 30 to 40% of a baby's blood volume. And pumping up that blood supply can significantly improve a baby's iron and hemoglobin levels, preventing anemia in the first 6 months of life. And how's this for a possible, if unexpected, perk? Delayed cord clamping may boost social and fine motor skills later in life. How long a wait is long enough? That depends who you ask. Many midwives routinely wait until the cord stops pulsating, which can take several minutes, often more. In fact, the American College of Nurse Midwives recommends delaying umbilical cord clamping for term and preterm infants for 2 to 5 minutes after birth. The World Health Organization, WHO, recommends waiting 1 to 3 minutes after birth to cut the umbilical cord. ACOG and AAP recommend delaying cord clamping until at least 30 to 60 seconds after birth. Delayed cord clamping is especially important for preterm babies, who can benefit significantly from the extra blood and the lowered risk of anemia. Studies have shown that premature infants whose cord clamping is delayed require fewer blood transfusions and experience fewer complications in the NICU. ACOG also recommends that because there's a very small increase in jaundice among babies whose cord clamping is delayed, practitioners should ensure that therapies to monitor and treat neonatal jaundice, aka phototherapy, are in place. Wondering what your practitioner's cord clamping practice is? Now, before the cord is delivered, along with your baby and the placenta, is the time to ask and to specify any preferences you have in your birth plan. For healthy moms with normal pregnancies, a 2 to 3 minute delay might be just what the doctor ordered, and it won't interfere with your first introduction to your baby. Assuming all is well, baby will still be placed on your belly for skin-to-skin contact, you'll still be able to dry and stimulate your baby for that first cry, and you'll still be able to gaze into those beautiful baby eyes. It also won't interfere with cord blood harvesting, though studies show that you might yield a lower volume of cord blood to bank compared to a faster cord clamping.
Wear and tear during delivery. When a little baby with a pretty big head tries to squeeze through a much narrower opening, there's a good chance that opening will not only be stretched out to accommodate it, but also might tear a little. In fact, it's common, given the pressure from a baby's head pushing through, to experience tears and lacerations in the perineum, the area between your vagina and your anus, and sometimes the cervix as well. As many as half of all women who deliver vaginally will experience at least a small tear during delivery, though your chances of tearing in second and subsequent labors are lower. First-degree tears, where only the skin is torn, and second-degree tears, when skin and vaginal tissue are torn, are the most common types of tears. In most cases, a tear requires stitches. They're generally required in tears that are longer than 2 centimeters, or about 1 inch. After the tear is repaired, you'll likely experience tenderness at the site as it heals over the next week to 10 days. But here's the good news. Recovering from a small tear that happens naturally is a lot easier than healing after an episiotomy, a procedure that's, thankfully, rarely used these days in uncomplicated births. To reduce the possibility that you'll tear, some experts recommend perineal massage for a few weeks before your due date if you're a first-time mom. If you've delivered vaginally before, you're already stretched, so do a head massage probably won't accomplish much. During labor, the following can also help: warm compresses to lessen perineal discomfort, perineal massage with oils or lubricants, standing or squatting and exhaling or grunting while pushing to facilitate stretching of the perineum. During the pushing stage, your practitioner will probably use perineal support, applying gentle counterpressure to the perineum so your baby's head doesn't push out too quickly and cause an unnecessary tear, and perineal massage. Lotus birth. If delaying cord clamping might be beneficial, what about not cutting the cord at all? That's the theory behind the controversial practice of lotus birth. Instead of cutting the cord, parents opt to leave the umbilical cord and placenta attached to their baby until it dries out and falls off by itself, a process that can take 3 to 10 or more days. Advocates say this allows the baby to reap the benefit of complete blood transfer from the cord and placenta. Problem is, there are no scientific studies on the safety of the practice, and experts haven't been reassuring. They say that without active blood circulation, the cord and placenta are essentially dead tissue that will rot and smell. Bacteria can colonize in the placenta and potentially be a source of infection that can spread to the newborn, which means that lotus birth most likely isn't a smart trend to embrace and may even be downright dangerous. Still curious? Be sure to discuss the practice with your practitioner before making the decision to try it. All about childbirth.
After 9 months at it, graduating from queasiness and bloating to heartburn and backache, you almost certainly know what to expect when you're expecting by now. But what should you expect when you're laboring and delivering? That's actually hard to predict. Make that impossible. Like every pregnancy before it, every labor and delivery is different. Still, just as it was comforting to know what you might expect during those months of growing your baby, it'll be comforting to have a general idea of what you might have in store for you during those hours of childbirth. Even if it turns out to be nothing like you expected, with the exception of that very happy and cuddly ending.
Stage 1. Labor.
Phase 1. Early labor. This phase is usually the longest phase of labor, but fortunately, it's also by far the least intense. Over a period of hours, days, or weeks, often without noticeable or bothersome contractions, or over a period of 2 to 6 hours of no doubt about it contractions, your cervix will efface, thin out, and dilate, open, to between 4 to 6 centimeters. Contractions in this phase usually last 30 to 45 seconds, though they can be shorter. They're mild to moderately strong, may be regular or irregular. They may start as far apart as 20 minutes, but will become progressively closer together, about 5 minutes apart by the end of early labor, though not necessarily in a consistent pattern. What you may be feeling. During early labor, you might experience any or all or none of the following. Backache, either constant or with each contraction. Menstrual-like cramps, Lower abdominal pressure, indigestion, diarrhea, a sensation of warmth in your abdomen, loss of mucus plug, bloody show, blood-tinged mucus. Rupture of your membranes, your water breaking, though it's more likely they'll rupture or be ruptured during active labor. Emotionally, you may be all over the map, from relaxed, relieved, excited, and chatty, to tense, anxious, and apprehensive. You may also be impatient while you're waiting, and waiting, for labor to get more active. What you can do? Of course you're full of anticipation, but it's important to relax, or at least try to relax. This could take a while. If contractions start during the night, but your water hasn't broken, try to sleep. You might not be able to later when the contractions are coming fast and furious. If you can't sleep, what with all the adrenaline pumping, get up and do things around the house that will distract you. Bake some muffins or cook up a batch of chili or chicken breasts to add to your postpartum freezer stash. Do the laundry or log on to see if anyone else in the whattoexpect.com community is in the same early labor boat. If it's daytime, go about your usual routine, as long as it doesn't take you far from home. Remember to take your cell phone with you. If you're at work, you might want to head home. It's not like you're going to get anything done anyway. If you have nothing planned, find something relaxing to keep you occupied. Go for a walk, watch TV, text friends and family, or keep them posted on Facebook. Finish packing your bag. Feel like starting labor and delivery fresh, even if you won't end up that way when it's over. Take a shower and wash your hair. Alert the media. Okay, maybe not the media yet, but you'll definitely want to put your partner on alert if he's not with you. He probably doesn't have to rush to your side just yet if he's at work, unless he really wants to, since there's not much for him to do this early on. If you've hired a doula, issue a bulletin to her too. And if you have older children who will need watching while you're laboring, alert the babysitter. Eat a light snack or meal if you're hungry. Broth, toast with jam, plain pasta or rice, jello or pudding, an ice pop, a banana, watermelon, or something else your practitioner has suggested. Now's the best time to stock up on energy foods. But don't eat heavily and avoid hard-to-digest foods, burgers, potato chips, pizza. You may also want to skip anything acidic, such as orange juice or lemonade. And definitely drink some water. It's important to stay hydrated. Make yourself comfortable. If you're achy, take a warm shower or use a heating pad where it hurts. You can also take some acetaminophen, Tylenol, if your practitioner approves, but don't take aspirin or ibuprofen, Advil or Motrin. Time contractions from the beginning of one to the beginning of the next for half an hour if they seem to be getting closer than 10 minutes apart, and periodically even if they don't. But try not to be a constant clock watcher. Remember to pee often, even if you're not feeling the urge to. A full bladder could slow down the progress of labor. Use relaxation techniques if they help, but don't start breathing exercises yet, or you'll burn out on them long before you need them.
Stages and phases of childbirth. Childbirth progresses in three stages: labor, delivery of the baby, and delivery of the placenta. First up, unless a planned C-section eliminates this stage entirely, is labor, which is divided into three phases: early labor, active labor, and transitional labor. All women who deliver vaginally will experience all three phases of labor, though some moms may barely notice much of the first phase at all. But moms who end up requiring a cesarean delivery at some point during labor may skip one or more of those phases. Though every labor is different, the timing and intensity of contractions can help pinpoint which phase of labor you're in at any particular time, and so can some of the symptoms you're experiencing along the way. Periodic internal exams will confirm your progress. Keep in mind that different practitioners define phases differently, which is why you'll notice a range of centimeters dilated within each phase below. Stage 1, labor. Phase 1, early, latent. Thinning, effacement, and opening, dilation, of the cervix to between 4 to 6 centimeters. Contractions are 30 to 45 seconds long, 20 minutes apart or less, getting to about 5 minutes apart by the end of early labor. Phase 2, active. Dilation of cervix from between 4 to 6 centimeters to between 7 to 8 centimeters, Contractions are 40 to 60 seconds long, coming 3 to 4 minutes apart. Phase 3, transitional. Dilation of cervix from between 7 to 8 centimeters to 10 centimeters, fully dilated. Contractions are 60 to 90 seconds long, about 2 to 3 minutes apart. Stage 2, pushing and delivery of the baby. Stage 3, delivery of the placenta. Call your practitioner if your practitioner probably told you not to call until you're in more active labor, but may have suggested that you call early on if labor begins during the day or if your membranes rupture. Definitely call immediately, however, if your membranes rupture and the amniotic fluid is murky or greenish, if you have any bright red vaginal bleeding, if you feel no fetal activity, or if there's an extremely marked slowdown or other dramatic change of fetal movement.
For dads, what you can do during early labor. If you're around during this phase, here are some ways you can help out. Practice timing contractions. The interval between contractions is time from the beginning of one to the beginning of the next. Time them periodically. You'll both get frustrated if you time early contractions too often, and keep a record. When they're coming less than 10 minutes apart, time them more frequently. Spread the calm. Right now, your most important job is to keep your partner relaxed. And the best way to do that is to keep yourself relaxed, both inside and out. It's possible to spread stress without even realizing it, communicating it not just through words, but touch and expressions. So no tensed up foreheads, please. Doing relaxation exercises together or giving her a gentle massage may help. It's too soon, however, to begin using breathing exercises. Save them for when they're needed so she doesn't burn out. For now, just breathe. Offer comfort, reassurance, and support. She'll need them from now on. Keep your sense of humor and help her keep hers. Time flies after all when you're having fun. It'll be easier to laugh now than when contractions are coming fast and hard. She probably won't find very much of anything funny then. Try distraction. Suggest activities that will help keep both your minds off her labor. Playing games on the iPad, watching a silly sitcom or reality show, baking something for the postpartum freezer stash, taking short strolls. Keep up your own strength so you'll be able to reinforce hers. Eat periodically, but empathetically. Don't go wolfing down a Big Mac when she's sticking to pudding. Prepare a sandwich to take along to the hospital or birthing center, but avoid anything with a strong odor. She probably won't be in the mood to be sniffing salami or onions on your breath.
On to the hospital or birthing center. Sometime near the end of the early phase or the beginning of the active phase, probably when your contractions are 5 minutes apart or less, sooner if you live far from the hospital or are likely to face traffic, or if this isn't your first baby, your practitioner will tell you to pick up your bag and get going. The going will be easier, of course, if your coach can be reached and get to you quickly, or you have a backup plan if he can't, like taking a taxi or having a friend drive you. Don't try to drive yourself. It will also be a smoother ride if you've planned your route in advance, are familiar with parking, and know which entrance will get you to labor and delivery fastest. En route, get as comfortable as you can. Recline the seat if possible. Bring a blanket if you have chills. But don't forget to fasten your seatbelt. Once you reach the hospital or birthing center, you can probably expect something like the following. Since protocols differ, your experience may be a little different. If you've pre-registered, and it's best if you have, the admission process will be quick and easy. If you haven't pre-registered, you, or better yet, your coach, will have to go through a more lengthy process, so be prepared to fill out a bunch of forms and answer a lot of questions. Once you've arrived at labor and delivery, a nurse will probably take you to your room, likely an LDR, or labor, delivery, and recovery room. If it's not clear you're in active labor, you may be brought first to a triage assessment room. This is standard practice in some hospitals. Your nurse will take a brief history, asking, among other things, when the contractions started, how far apart they are, whether your membranes have ruptured, when and what you last ate. Your nurse will ask for your signature or your spouse's on routine consent forms. Your nurse will give you a hospital gown to change into and might request a urine sample. He or she will check your pulse, blood pressure, respiration, and temperature, look for leaking amniotic fluid, bleeding, or bloody show, and will listen to baby's heartbeat with a Doppler or hook you up to a fetal monitor if necessary. He or she may also evaluate baby's position. Your nurse, your practitioner, or a staff doctor or midwife will examine you internally to see how dilated and effaced your cervix is. Have questions? Now's a great time to ask them. Have a birth plan? Now's a good time to hand it to the nurse so it can be added to your chart. If at any time during the intake it's determined that you're not actually in active labor, you may be sent home, don't worry, you'll be back, or asked to stay for a few hours before checking you again.
Phase 2. Active labor. The active phase of labor is usually shorter than the early phase, lasting an average of 2 to 3.5 hours, with again a wide range of normal. The contractions are more concentrated now, accomplishing more in less time, and they're also increasingly intense, in other words, painful. As they become stronger, longer, 40 to 60 seconds with a distinct peak about halfway through, and more frequent, generally 3 to 4 minutes apart, though the pattern may not be regular, the cervix dilates to 7 to 8 centimeters. With fewer breaks in the action, there's less opportunity to rest between contractions. What you may be feeling. You'll likely be in the hospital or birthing center by now, and you can expect to feel all or some of the following, though you won't feel pain if you've had an epidural. Increasing pain and discomfort with contractions. You may not be able to talk through them now. Increasing backache, leg discomfort, aches in the legs, thighs, or butt, or heaviness. Fatigue. Increasing bloody show. Rupture of your membranes if they haven't earlier. Emotionally, you may feel restless and find it more difficult to relax, or your concentration may become more intense, and you may become completely absorbed in your labor efforts. Your confidence may begin to waver, how will I make it through, along with your patience, will this labor never end? Or you may feel excited and encouraged that things are really starting to happen. Whatever your feelings, they're normal. Just get ready to start getting active. What your practitioner or nurse will be doing. During active labor, assuming all is progressing normally and safely, your birth attendants will check and monitor you as needed, but also allow you to work through labor with your coach and other support people without interference. You can expect them to take your blood pressure, monitor baby with a Doppler or fetal monitor, time and monitor the strength of your contractions, evaluate bloody show, start an IV if you're going to want an epidural or if hospital policy dictates, administer an epidural or other pain relief if you choose to have one. The anesthesiologist will have to be called in for this. Possibly rupture your membranes if they're still intact. Jumpstart your labor if it's progressing very slowly by administering Pitocin. Periodically examine you internally to check how labor is progressing and how dilated and effaced your cervix is. They'll also be able to answer any questions you might have. Don't be shy about asking or having your coach ask, and provide additional support as you go through labor. What you can do. It's all about your comfort now, so don't hesitate to ask your coach for whatever you need to get and stay as comfortable as possible, whether it's a back rub to ease the ache or a damp washcloth to cool your face. Speaking up will be important. Remember, as much as he's going to want to help, he's going to have a hard time anticipating your needs, especially if this is his first time coaching labor. Start your breathing exercises, if you plan to use them, as soon as contractions become too strong to talk through. Didn't plan ahead and practice? Ask the nurse or doula for some simple breathing suggestions. Remember to do whatever relaxes you and makes you feel more comfortable. If the formulaic breathing exercises aren't working for you, don't feel obligated to stick with them, or ask the nurse or your doula to help you redirect your breathing. Try to relax fully between contractions so you can conserve energy that you'll need later. This will become increasingly difficult as they come more frequently, but it will also become increasingly important as your energy reserves are drained. If you'd like some pain relief, now's a good time to ask for it. An epidural can be given as early as you feel you need it, and as soon as an anesthesiologist can get to your room. Stay hydrated. With your practitioner's green light, drink clear beverages frequently to replace fluids and to keep your mouth moist. If you're hungry, and again, if you have your practitioner's okay, have a light snack like a Jell-O or popsicle. If your practitioner doesn't allow anything else by mouth, sucking on ice chips can be refreshing. Stay on the move if you can. You won't be able to get around much if you have an epidural. Walk around if possible, or at least change positions as needed. Taking a shower or soaking in a tub now can help ease your pain if you don't have an epidural. Pee periodically. Because of tremendous pelvic pressure, you may not notice the need to empty your bladder, but a full bladder can prevent baby's descent and keep you from making the progress you'll definitely want to be making. No need to trek to the bathroom if you have an epidural, not that you could anyway, because you've probably been given a catheter to empty your bladder.
Don't hyperventilate. With all the breathing going on during labor, some moms start to hyperventilate or overbreathe, causing low levels of carbon dioxide in the blood. If you feel dizzy or lightheaded, have blurred vision, or a tingling and numbness of your fingers and toes, let a nurse or your doula know. You'll be given a paper bag to breathe into or told to breathe into your cupped hands. A few inhales and exhales will get you feeling better in no time. When labor slows down. Feel like lingering over labor? Of course not. You'd like to keep labor moving. And making good progress during labor, which happens most of the time, requires three main components: strong uterine contractions that effectively dilate the cervix, a baby that is in position for an easy exit, and a pelvis that is roomy enough to permit passage of the baby. But in some cases, labor doesn't progress by the book. Because the cervix takes its time dilating, the baby takes longer than expected to descend, or pushing isn't getting you or your baby anywhere. Contractions can also slow down after an epidural kicks in too. But keep in mind that expectations for the progress of labor and delivery are different for those who have an epidural. First and second stage may take longer, and that's typically nothing to worry about. To get a stalled labor back up and running, there are a number of steps your practitioner and you can take. If you're in early labor and your cervix just isn't dilating or effacing, your practitioner may suggest some activity, such as walking, or just the opposite, sleep and rest, possibly aided by relaxation techniques. This will also help rule out false labor. The contractions of false labor usually subside with activity or a nap. If you're not dilating or effacing as quickly as expected, your practitioner may try to rev things up by administering Pitocin, oxytocin, prostaglandin E, or another labor stimulator. He or she might even suggest a labor booster that you can take into your own hands or your coach's, nipple stimulation. If you're already in the active phase of labor, but your cervix is dilating slowly, less than 1 to 1.2 centimeters per hour if you're having your first baby, and 1.5 centimeters per hour if you've delivered before, or if your baby isn't moving quickly enough down the birth canal, at a rate of more than 1 centimeter per hour if you're a first-timer, or 2 centimeters per hour if you're not, your practitioner may rupture your membranes and/or start or continue administering oxytocin. Some practitioners, especially midwives, will encourage a woman to labor longer than this before resorting to interventions, as long as baby's heart rate is good and mom doesn't have a fever. If you're a first-time mom, you'll probably be allowed to push for 3 hours if you haven't had an epidural, and 4 hours if you have. If you're a second-timer or more, you'll probably be allowed to push for 2 hours if you haven't had an epidural, and 3 hours if you have had one. If the pushing goes on too long, your practitioner will reassess your baby's position, see how you're feeling, perhaps attempt to birth your baby using vacuum extraction, or, less likely, forceps, or decide to do a cesarean delivery. To keep the ball and the baby rolling throughout labor, remember to urinate periodically because a full bladder can interfere with the baby's descent. If you have an epidural, chances are your bladder is being emptied by a catheter. Full bowels may do the same, so if you haven't moved your bowels in 24 hours, give it a try. You might also try to nudge a sluggish labor along by using gravity, sitting upright, squatting, standing, or walking. When it comes to giving slow pushing a push, a semi-sitting, semi-squatting, or all fours position may help deliver results. Most practitioners will turn to a cesarean delivery after 24 hours of active labor, sometimes sooner if sufficient progress hasn't been made by that time. Some will wait longer, assuming both mom and baby are doing well.
For dads, what you can do during active labor. Labor's getting more active, and that means you'll be getting busier supporting your laboring spouse. Here's some ways you can help her. Hand a copy of the birth plan to the nurse so that it can be placed in your partner's chart, if it hasn't been already. If the shift changes, make sure the new nurse is in the loop too. If mom wants pain relief, let the nurse or practitioner know. Support whatever decision she makes, to continue unmedicated or to go for pain relief, even if this decision represents a change of plans. Take your cues from her. Whatever mom wants, mom should get. Keep in mind that what she'll want may change from moment to moment. The TV blaring one second, TV off the next. Ditto for her mood and her reaction to you. Don't take it personally if she doesn't respond to, doesn't appreciate, or is even annoyed by your attempts to comfort her. Ease up, if that's what she seems to prefer. But be prepared to step it up 10 minutes later if she wants. Remember that your role is important, even if you sometimes feel unneeded, unwanted, or just plain in the way. She'll appreciate you in the morning, or whenever it's all over. Set the mood. If possible, keep the door to the room closed, the lights low, and the room quiet to promote a relaxed and restful atmosphere. Soft music may also help, unless you'd rather watch TV. Remember, she's the boss right now. Continue encouraging relaxation techniques between contractions and breathing with her through the contractions. But don't push if she's not into them, or if the relaxation agenda is starting to stress her out. If distractions seem to help her, turn to cards or game apps, light music, or TV. But distract her only as much as she seems to want to be distracted. Pump her up. Reassure her and praise her efforts, unless your verbal reassurance is making her more edgy, and avoid criticism of any kind, even the constructive type. Be her cheerleader, but keep it low-key since she probably won't appreciate full-on exuberance, particularly if progress is slow. Suggest that she take her labor one contraction at a time and remind her that each pain brings her closer to seeing the baby. If she finds your cheers irritating, however, just support her gently. Stick to sympathy if that's what she seems to need. Keep track of the contractions. If she's on a monitor, ask the practitioner or the nurse to show you how to read it. Later, when contractions are coming one on top of the other, you can announce each new contraction as it begins. The monitor may detect the tensing of the uterus before she can, and can let her know when she's having one if she can't feel them, thanks to an epidural. You can also encourage mom through those tough contractions by telling her when each peak is ending. If there is no monitor, ask a nurse to show you how to recognize the arrival and departure of contractions with your hand on her abdomen, unless she doesn't want it there. Massage her neck or back, or use counterpressure or any other techniques you've learned to make her more comfortable. Let her tell you what kind of stroking or touching or massage helps. If she prefers not to be touched at all, comfort her verbally. Remember, what feels good one moment might rub her the wrong way the next, and vice versa. Remind her to take a bathroom break at least once an hour if she doesn't have a catheter. She might not feel the urge, but a full bladder can stand in the way of labor progress. Suggest a change of positions, or suggest a shower or a soak in the tub to help ease the pain. Be the iceman. Find out where the ice machine is and keep those chips coming. If she's allowed to sip on fluids or snack on light foods, offer them periodically. Popsicles may be especially refreshing, so ask the nurse if there's a stash you can help yourself to. Keep her cool. Use a damp washcloth, wrung out in cold water, to help cool her body and face. Refresh it often. If her feet are cold, offer to get out a pair of socks and put them on her. Reaching her own feet won't be easy. Be her voice and her ears. She has enough going on, so lighten her load. Serve as her go-between with medical personnel as much as possible. Intercept questions from them that you can answer, and ask for explanations of procedures, equipment, and use of medication so you'll be able to tell her what's happening. For instance, now might be the time to find out if a mirror will be provided so she can view the delivery. Be her advocate if she's unhappy about a procedure or policy, but stay calm as you intervene on her behalf so she doesn't get more upset.
Phase 3. Transitional labor. Transition is the most demanding phase of labor, but happily, typically the quickest. Suddenly, the intensity of the contractions picks up. They become very strong, 2 to 3 minutes apart, and 60 to 90 seconds long, with very intense peaks that last for most of the contraction. Some moms, especially those who've given birth before, experience multiple peaks. You may feel as though the contractions never disappear completely, and you can't completely relax between them. The final 2 to 3 centimeters of dilation, to a full 10 centimeters, will probably take place in a very short time. On average, 15 minutes to an hour, though it can also take as long as 3 hours. What you may be feeling. You'll feel plenty when you're in transition, unless, of course, you've had an epidural, and may experience some or all of the following. More intense pain with contractions, strong pressure in the lower back and or perineum, rectal pressure, an increase in your bloody show as more capillaries in the cervix rupture, feeling very warm and sweaty or chilled and shaky, or you might alternate between the two, crampy legs that may tremble uncontrollably, nausea and or vomiting, drowsiness between contractions as oxygen is diverted from your brain to the site of the delivery, a tightening sensation in your throat or chest, exhaustion. Emotionally, you may feel vulnerable and overwhelmed, as though you're reaching the end of your rope. In addition to frustration over not being able to push yet, you may feel discouraged, irritable, disoriented, and restless, and you may have difficulty concentrating and relaxing. It might seem impossible to do either. You may also find excitement reaching a fever pitch in the midst of all the stress. Your baby's almost here. What you can do. Hang in there. By the end of this phase, which is not far off, your cervix will be fully dilated, and it will be time to begin pushing your baby out. Continue to use breathing techniques if they help. If you feel the urge to push, resist. Pant or blow instead, unless you've been instructed otherwise. Pushing against a cervix that isn't completely dilated can cause it to swell, which can delay delivery. If you didn't have an epidural before but would like one now, ask for it. If you don't want anybody to touch you unnecessarily, if your coach's once comforting hands now irritate you, don't hesitate to let him know. Try to relax between contractions as much as is possible with slow, deep, rhythmic breathing. Keep your eye on the prize. That bundle of joy will soon be arriving in your arms.
For dads, what you can do during transitional labor. The going's getting tough, but here's how to help your partner in labor keep going. If your laboring spouse has an epidural or other kind of pain relief, ask her if she needs another dose. Transition can be quite painful, and if her epidural is wearing off, she won't be a happy camper. If it is, let the nurses or the practitioner know. If mom's continuing unmedicated, she'll need you more now than ever. Read on. Be there, but give her space if she seems to want it. Often, women in transition don't like being touched. But as always, take your cues from her. Allow her to lean on you if she wants. Abdominal massage may be especially offensive now, though counterpressure applied to the small of her back may continue to provide some relief from back pain. Be prepared to back off, even from her back, as directed. Don't waste words. Now's not the time for small talk and probably not for jokes either. Offer quiet comfort and guide her with words that are brief and direct. Offer lots of encouragement unless she prefers you to keep quiet. At this moment, eye contact or touch may communicate more expressively than words. Breathe with her through every contraction if it seems to help her through them. Help her rest and relax between contractions, touching her abdomen lightly to show her when a contraction is over. Remind her to use slow, rhythmic breathing in between contractions if she can. If her contractions seem to be getting closer and/or she feels the urge to push, and she hasn't been examined recently, let the nurse or practitioner know. She may be fully dilated. Offer her ice chips or a sip of water frequently, and mop her brow with a cool damp cloth often. If she's chilly, offer her a blanket or a pair of socks. Stay focused on the payoff you're both about to get. It won't be long before the pushing begins, and that anticipated bundle arrives in your arms.
Baby's movements during labor. You've been counting and enjoying baby's kicks for the last few months, attuned to your wee one's every wiggle. But what about during labor? Is your baby still kicking up those cute little feet? And will you be able to feel those movements? The answer is yes, and maybe. Your baby will still move around during labor, and in fact may do some impressive spins to help ease out of the birth canal. But you may not feel much of that movement at all. First, your focus, understandably, is likely to be on those contractions, making movements easy to miss. Second, if you've had an epidural, you'll be numb, which means you might not feel a thing, including those movements. But that's where fetal monitors or Dopplers come in, to track baby's heartbeat, assuring all is well. One less thing for you to have to worry about during labor.
Laboring down or immediate pushing? Woohoo! You've reached that magic 10-centimeter mark. You're fully dilated, and it's finally time to start pushing out baby. Or is it? Some doctors and midwives practice the art of laboring down, which means you don't start pushing in earnest until baby's head is at +2 station or nearly crowning, or until you feel that tremendous urge to push, even if you're already fully dilated. This process of allowing your uterus to bring baby down the birth canal can take a few minutes or an hour or two, during which you'll follow only natural, gentle urges to push or not push at all. Why do some practitioners promote laboring down? So you can conserve energy until it's really needed and take a rest while your uterus does the heavy lifting. Have an epidural? You can still labor down. But is laboring down all it's cracked up to be? Not necessarily, at least according to the latest research. Study results show that for first-time moms with epidurals, laboring down can actually increase the risk of childbirth complications and even lengthen the total time it takes to push baby out, which leads experts to recommend against laboring down, saying there are no significant benefits to delayed pushing and that moms should aim for immediate pushing instead. Not sure what you should do when the time comes? Have a conversation with your practitioner before the big moment arrives.
Stage 2. Pushing and delivery.
Up until this point, your active participation in the birth of your baby has been negligible. Though you've definitely taken most of the abuse, your cervix and uterus and baby have done most of the work. But that's about to change. Now that dilation is complete, it's your turn to push your baby the rest of the way through the birth canal and out, unless you'll be laboring down, in which case you can catch a break before you begin pushing. Pushing and delivery generally take between 30 minutes and an hour, but sometimes can be accomplished in 10 or even fewer short minutes, or in 2, 3, or even more very long hours. The contractions of the second stage are usually more regular than the contractions of transition. They are still about 60 to 90 seconds in duration, but sometimes further apart, usually about 2 to 5 minutes, and possibly less painful, though sometimes they are more intense. There now should be a well-defined rest period between them, though you may still have trouble recognizing the onset of each contraction. What you may be feeling. Common in the second stage, though you'll definitely feel the falling a lot less and may not feel anything at all if you've had an epidural. Pain with the contractions, though possibly not as much. An overwhelming urge to push, though not every mom feels this, especially with an epidural. Tremendous rectal pressure, ditto. A burst of renewed energy, a second wind, or fatigue. Very visible contractions with your uterus rising noticeably with each. An increase in bloody show. A tingling, stretching, burning, or stinging sensation at the vaginal opening as your baby's head crowns. It's called the ring of fire for good reason. A slippery, wet feeling as your baby emerges. Emotionally, you may feel relieved, exhilarated, and excited that you can now start pushing, or if the pushing stretches on for much more than an hour, frustrated or overwhelmed. In a prolonged second stage, you may find your preoccupation is less with seeing the baby than with getting the ordeal over with, and that's perfectly understandable. Some moms can also feel inhibited or unsure when they begin pushing, especially if they don't quite get the hang of it at first. After all, birthing a baby is a natural process, but it doesn't always come naturally. What you can do. It's time to get this baby out. So get into a pushing position, which one will depend on the bed, chair, or tub you're in, what's most comfortable and effective for you, and your practitioner's preferences. A semi-sitting or semi-squatting position is often the best because it enlists the aid of gravity in the birthing process and may offer you more pushing power. Tucking your chin to your chest when you're in this position will help you focus your pushes where they need to be. Sometimes if the pushing isn't moving your baby down the birth canal, it may be helpful to change positions. If you've been semi-sitting, for example, you might want to get up on all fours. Once you're ready to begin pushing, give it all you've got. The more efficiently you push and the more energy you pack into the effort, the more quickly your baby will make the trip through the birth canal. Frantic, disorganized pushing wastes energy and accomplishes little. Plus, it can take its toll on you. Keep these pushing pointers in mind. Relax your upper body and your thighs and then push as if you're having a bowel movement, the biggest one of your life. Focus your energy on your vagina and rectum, not your chest, which could result in chest pain after delivery, and not your face. Straining with your face could cause bruises on your cheeks and bloodshot eyes, not to mention do nothing to help get your baby out. It may help to look down past your bump as you push. Speaking of bowel movements, since you're bearing down on the whole perineal area, anything that's in your rectum may be pushed out too. Trying to avoid this while you're pushing can slow your progress. Don't let inhibition or embarrassment break the pushing rhythm. Involuntary pooping or peeing is experienced by nearly everyone during delivery. No one else in the room will think twice about it, and neither should you. You probably won't even notice it. Pads will immediately whisk away anything that comes out. Take a few deep breaths while the contraction is building so you can gear up for pushing. As the contraction peaks, take a deep breath and then push with all your might, holding your breath if you want or exhaling as you push, whatever feels right to you. If you'd like the nurse or your coach to guide you by counting to 10 while you push, that's fine. But if you find it breaks your rhythm or isn't helpful, ask them not to. There is no magic formula when it comes to how long each push should last or how many times you should push with each contraction. The most important thing is to do what comes naturally. You may feel as many as 5 urges to bear down, with each push lasting just seconds. Or you may feel the urge to bear down just twice, but with each push lasting longer. Follow those urges and you'll deliver your baby. Actually, you'll deliver your baby even if you don't follow your urges or if you find you don't have any urges at all. Pushing doesn't come naturally for every woman. And if it doesn't for you, your practitioner, nurse, or doula can help direct your efforts and redirect them if you lose your concentration. Don't become frustrated if you see the baby's head crown and then disappear again. Birthing is a two steps forward, one step backward proposition. Just remember, baby's moving in the right direction. Rest between contractions. If you're really exhausted, especially when the pushing stage drags on, your practitioner may suggest that you not push for several contractions so you can rebuild your strength. Stop pushing when you're instructed to, as you may be to keep the baby's head from being born too rapidly. If you're feeling the urge to push when you're asked not to push, pant or blow instead. Remember to keep an eye on the mirror, if one is available, once there's something to look at. Seeing your baby's head crown and reaching down and touching it may give you the inspiration to push when the pushing gets tough. Besides, unless your coach or someone else is taking a video, there won't be any replays to watch. What your practitioner and nurse will be doing. While you're pushing, the nurse and or your practitioner will give you support and direction, and if necessary, will use their hands to apply some gentle pressure on your abdomen to help coax baby down. Continue to monitor your baby's heartbeat with either a Doppler or a fetal monitor, and prepare for delivery by spreading sterile drapes and arranging instruments, donning surgical garments and gloves, and sponging your perineal area with antiseptic, though midwives generally just don gloves and don't do any draping. Most practitioners will use their fingers to gently stretch the perineum before your baby's head emerges. Some will use lubricants or oils like olive or mineral oil to make your perineum slippery, enabling baby's head to glide out more easily and avoid tears. If necessary, it's unlikely, an episiotomy will be performed, or possibly vacuum extraction, or even less likely, forceps will be used. Once your baby's head emerges, your practitioner will suction your baby's nose and mouth to remove excess mucus, then help ease the shoulders and torso out. You probably will have to give only one more small push to help with that. The head was the hard part, and the rest slides out pretty easily. Your baby will be handed to you or placed on your belly. The umbilical cord will be clamped and cut, either by the practitioner or by your coach, and the doctor, midwife, or nurse will give baby a rub to help get his or her breathing and crying going. If you've arranged for cord blood collection, it will be done now. This is a great time for some caressing and skin-to-skin contact, so lift up your gown and bring baby close. In case you need a reason to do that, studies show that infants who have skin-to-skin contact with their mothers just after delivery sleep longer and are calmer hours later. Breastfeeding could be initiated now, or if need be, after the initial evaluation. Here's a fun fact. If you keep your newborn skin-to-skin on your belly after birth, he or she will instinctively creep over a period of 20 minutes to an hour or longer towards your breast, find your nipple, bobbing that cute little head while searching for it, and then latch on. What's next for your baby? The nurses and or pediatrician will evaluate baby's condition and rate it on the Apgar scale at 1 minute and 5 minutes after birth. See what to expect the first year for more. Give a brisk, stimulating and drying rubdown. Possibly take baby's footprints for a keepsake, attach an identifying band to your wrists and to baby's dad's wrists, and to your baby's ankle, administer non-irritating eye ointment to prevent infection. You can ask that the ointment be administered after you've had time to cuddle with your newborn. Weigh baby and then wrap baby to prevent heat loss or put him or her back on your chest. In some hospitals and most birthing centers, some of these procedures may be omitted. In others, many will be attended to later so you can have more time to bond with your newborn. Then you'll get your baby back, assuming all is well, and you may begin breastfeeding if you haven't already and you'd like to. Sometime after that, baby will get a more complete pediatric exam and some routine protective procedures, including a heel stick, vitamin K shot, and hepatitis B vaccine. Baby's first bath will likely be delayed for at least 8 to 24 hours, or even longer after a C-section, to optimize bonding and breastfeeding, help prevent infection, reduce the risk of low blood sugar, and keep baby warm.
For dads, what you can do during pushing and delivery. It's push time, and here's how you can help. Continue giving comfort and support. A whispered, "I love you," can be more valuable to her during the pushing stage than anything else. But don't feel hurt if the object of your efforts doesn't seem to notice you're there. Her energies are necessarily focused elsewhere. help her relax between the contractions, with soothing words, a cool cloth applied to forehead, neck, and shoulders, and, if feasible, back massage or counter pressure to help ease backache. If she's laboring down, encourage her to rest up. Continue to supply ice chips or sips of ice water to moisten her mouth as needed. She'll be parched from pushing. Support her back while she's pushing, if necessary. Hold her hand, wipe her brow, or do whatever else seems to help her. If she slips out of position, gently help her back into it. Periodically point out her progress. As the baby begins to crown, remind her to keep an eye on the mirror so she can have visual confirmation of what she is accomplishing. When she's not looking, or if there's no mirror, give her inch-by-inch descriptions. Take her hand and touch baby's head together for renewed inspiration. If you're offered the opportunity to catch your baby as he or she emerges, or later, to cut the cord, don't be afraid. Both are relatively easy jobs, and you'll get step-by-step directions and backup from the attendants. You should know, however, that the cord can't be snipped like a piece of string. It's tougher than you may think.
A first look at baby. After 40 or so weeks of waiting and too many hours of laboring and delivering, there's no doubt that your just-born baby will be a sight for your sore eyes, perfectly beautiful to you in every way. That said, 9 months of soaking in an amniotic bath, followed by compression in a contracting uterus and cramped birth canal, can take a temporary toll on a newborn's appearance. Babies who were neatly plucked from their uterine homes, especially if they arrived via a scheduled C-section before labor started, will have an initial edge in the looks department. They'll be rounder and smoother. What can you expect your newborn baby to look like at first sight, besides picture perfect? Here's a realistic heads up on some typical newborn characteristics head to toe. Oddly shaped head. At birth, an infant's head is proportionately the largest part of the body, with a circumference as large as his or her chest. As your baby grows, the rest of the body will catch up. Often, the head has molded to fit through mom's pelvis, giving it an odd, possibly pointed cone shape. If baby has pressed hard against your cervix before it was fully dilated, there may be a lump on that sweet noggin, too. The lump will disappear in a day or two, the molding within 2 weeks, at which point your baby's head will begin to take on that cherubic roundness. Newborn hair. Some newborns are virtually bald or sport just a light coating of peach fuzz. Some have a thick mane. But hair today will be gone eventually. All babies lose their newborn hair, though this may happen so gradually that you don't notice, and it will be replaced by new growth, possibly of a different color and texture. Vernix coating. Remember that cheesy coating that was keeping baby's skin protected in that amniotic bath? Premature babies have quite a lot of this coating at birth. On-time babies have just a little, and overdue babies may have none at all, except possibly in the skin folds and under fingernails. Swelling of breasts and genitals. Boy and girl parts can appear swollen at birth. Breasts of both male and female newborns can also be swollen, and sometimes even engorged, secreting a white or pink substance nicknamed witch's milk. Thanks not to their own hormones, but mom's. Those same hormones may also stimulate a white, sometimes blood-tinged vaginal discharge in baby girls. These effects are normal and will disappear in a week to 10 days. Puffy eyes. Swelling around the eyes, normal for someone who's been soaking in amniotic fluid for 9 months and then squeezed through a narrow birth canal, may be exacerbated by the ointment used to protect baby's eyes from infection. Most of the puffiness will, poof, disappear within a few days. Eye color, TBD. Brown? Green? Blue? For most babies, it's way too early to call. Caucasian baby eyes are usually, but not always, slate blue, no matter what color they will turn later on. In babies of color, eyes are usually brown at birth, but the shade of brown may ultimately do some changing. Skin surprises. Your baby's skin will appear pink, white, or even grayish at birth. even if it will eventually turn brown or black. That's because pigmentation doesn't show up until a few hours after birth. A variety of rashes, tiny pimples, and whiteheads may also mar your baby's skin, thanks to maternal hormones, but all are temporary. You may also notice skin dryness and cracking, caused by such a long soak in an amniotic bath and first-time exposure to air. These two will pass without any treatment. Lanugo. Fine downy hair called lanugo may cover the shoulders, back, forehead, and temples of full-term babies. This will usually be shed by the end of the first week. Such hair can be more abundant and will last longer in a premature baby and may already be gone in an overdue one. Birthmarks. A reddish blotch at the base of the skull, on the eyelid, or on the forehead, called a salmon patch, is very common, especially in Caucasian newborns. Mongolian spots, bluish-gray pigmentation of the deep skin layer that can appear on the back, buttocks, and sometimes the arms and thighs, are more common in Asians, Southern Europeans, and African Americans. These markings eventually disappear, usually by age 4. Hemangiomas, elevated strawberry-colored birthmarks, vary from tiny to about quarter size or even larger. They eventually fade to a mottled pearly gray, then often disappear entirely. Coffee with cream-colored, café au lait spots, can appear anywhere on the body. They're usually inconspicuous and don't fade. Stage 3. Delivery of the placenta.
The worst is over and the best has already come. All that remains is tying up the loose ends, so to speak. During this final stage of childbirth, which generally lasts anywhere from 5 to 30 minutes or more, the placenta, which has been your baby's life support inside the womb, will be delivered. You will continue to have mild contractions, approximately a minute in duration, though you may not feel them. After all, you're preoccupied with your newborn. The squeezing of the uterus separates the placenta from the uterine wall and moves it down into the lower segment of the uterus or into the vagina so it can be expelled. Your practitioner will help deliver the placenta by either pulling the cord gently with one hand while pressing and kneading your uterus with the other, or exerting downward pressure on the top of the uterus, asking you to push at the appropriate time. You might get some Pitocin, oxytocin, via injection or in your IV to encourage uterine contractions, which will speed delivery of the placenta, help shrink the uterus back to size, and minimize bleeding. Once the placenta is out, your practitioner will examine it to make sure it's intact. If it isn't, he or she will inspect your uterus manually for placental fragments and remove any that remain. If you'd like to keep the placenta, be sure your practitioner knows about this plan and that both he or she and the hospital have agreed to it ahead of time. Now that the work of labor and delivery is done, you may feel overwhelmingly exhausted or, conversely, experience a burst of renewed energy. You are likely to be very thirsty, and especially if labor has been long, and most especially if you weren't allowed to eat, hungry. Some women experience chills in this stage, while all experience a bloody vaginal discharge, called lochia, comparable to a heavy menstrual period. How will you feel emotionally after you've delivered your baby? Every new mom reacts a little differently, and your reaction is normal for you. Your first emotional response may be joy, but it's just as likely to be a sense of relief. You may be exhilarated and talkative, elated and excited, a little impatient at having to push out the placenta or submit to the repair of a tear or an episiotomy, or so in awe of what you're cuddling in your arms, or so beat, or a little bit of both, that you don't notice. You may feel a closeness to your partner and an immediate bond with your new baby. Or, and this is just as normal, you may feel somewhat detached. Who is this stranger sniffing at my breast? No matter what your response now, you will come to love your baby intensely. These things just sometimes take time. What you can do. Do some quality snuggling, skin to skin. Speak up too. Since your baby will recognize your voice, cooing, singing, or whispered words will be especially comforting. It's a strange new world, and you'll be able to help baby make some sense out of it. Under some circumstances, your baby may be kept in a heated bassinet for a while or be held by your coach while the placenta is being delivered. But not to worry, there's plenty of time for baby bonding. Spend some time bonding with your coach, too, and enjoying your cozy new threesome. Help deliver the placenta, if necessary, by pushing when directed. Some moms don't even have to push at all for the placenta to arrive. Your practitioner will let you know what to do, if anything. Hang in there during repair of any episiotomy or tears. Continue or start breastfeeding if baby is still with you. Take pride in your accomplishment. You did it, mama. All that's left to do then is for your practitioner to stitch up any tear. If you're not already numbed, you'll get a local anesthetic and clean you up. You'll likely get an ice pack to put on your perineum to minimize swelling. Ask for one if it's not offered. The nurse will also help you put on a maxi pad or add some thick pads on your bottom. Remember, you'll be bleeding a lot. Once you're feeling up to it, you'll be transferred to a postpartum room. Unless you're already in a labor, delivery, recovery, and postpartum room, or an LDRP.
For dads, what you can do after delivery. Your baby's here. While you're basking in the moment, you can also offer some well-earned words of praise to the new mom, and congratulate yourself, too, for a job well done. Begin bonding with your little one, with some holding and cuddling, and by doing some soft singing or talking. Remember, your baby has heard your voice a lot during his or her stay in the uterus and is familiar with its sound. Hearing it now will bring comfort in this strange new environment. Don't forget to do some cuddling and bonding with mom, too. Ask for an ice pack to soothe her perineal area if the nurse doesn't offer one. Ask for some juice for mom. She may be very thirsty. After she's been rehydrated and if both of you are in the mood, break out the bubbly. Champagne or sparkling cider if you brought some along. Snap baby's first photos or capture your amazing newborn on video. You'll also have the opportunity to be with your newborn for the first exam, first bath, and other routine procedures.
Cesarean delivery.
You won't be able to participate actively at a cesarean delivery the way you would at a vaginal one, and some would consider that a definite plus. Instead of huffing, puffing, and pushing your baby into the world, you'll get to lie back and let everybody else do all the heavy lifting. In fact, your most important contribution to your baby's cesarean birth will be preparation. The more you know, the more comfortable you'll feel, which is why it's a good idea to listen to this section ahead of time, even if you're not having a planned cesarean delivery. Thanks to regional anesthesia like epidurals and the liberalization of hospital regulations, most moms and their coaches are able to be full-on spectators at their cesarean deliveries. Because they aren't preoccupied with pushing or pain, they're often able to relax, at least to some degree, and marvel at the birth. This is what you can expect in a typical cesarean birth. An IV infusion will be started, if it isn't already in, to provide speedy access if additional medications or fluids are needed. Most doctors will give you antibiotics through your IV to prevent infection down the road. Anesthesia will be administered either an epidural or a spinal block, both of which numb the lower part of your body but allow you to be fully awake and alert. In rare emergency situations when a baby must be delivered immediately, a general anesthetic, which puts you to sleep, may be used. Your abdomen will be washed down with an antiseptic solution. A catheter, a narrow tube, will be inserted into your bladder to keep it empty and out of the surgeon's way. Sterile drapes will be arranged around your exposed abdomen. A screen will be put up at about shoulder level so you won't have to see the incision being made, though some hospitals have clear drapes so you can have a view of baby emerging. If your coach is going to attend the delivery, which he probably will be able to, he will be suited up in sterile garb. He will sit near your head so that he can give you emotional support and hold your hand, and he may have the option of viewing the actual surgery. If you've planned to have a doula with you during the delivery, she can be with you during the C-section as well. If yours is an emergency cesarean delivery, things may move very quickly. Try to stay calm in the face of all that activity, and don't let it worry you. That's just the way things work in a hospital sometimes. Once your doctor is certain that the anesthetic has taken effect, an incision, usually a horizontal bikini cut, is made in your lower abdomen, just above the pubic hairline. You may feel a sensation of being unzipped, but you won't feel any pain. A second incision, usually a low horizontal one, is then made, this time in your uterus. The amniotic sac is opened, and if it hasn't already ruptured, the fluid is suctioned out. You may hear a sort of gurgling or swishing sound. The baby is then eased out, usually while an assistant presses on the uterus. With an epidural, though not likely with a spinal block, you will probably feel some pulling and tugging sensations, as well as some pressure. If you're eager to see your baby's arrival and drapes are blocking the view, ask the doctor if the screen can be lowered slightly. Your baby's nose and mouth are then suctioned. Then you'll hear the first cry. The cord will be quickly clamped and cut, and you'll be allowed a quick glimpse of your newborn. In a hospital offering a gentle C-section, your baby may be placed on your chest, and you will be able to hold or even breastfeed your baby right away. While the baby is getting the same routine attention that a vaginally delivered infant receives, the doctor will remove the placenta. Now the doctor will quickly do a routine check of your reproductive organs and stitch up the incisions that were made. The uterine incision will be repaired with absorbable stitches, which do not have to be removed. The abdominal incision may be closed with either stitches, which may or may not be absorbable, or surgical staples. An injection of oxytocin may be given intramuscularly or inter-IV to help contract the uterus and control bleeding. You may have some cuddling time and even some skin-to-skin time in the delivery room, but a lot will depend on your condition and babies, as well as hospital rules. Many hospitals allow skin-to-skin time after cesarean delivery, as long as your baby is medically stable. Just ask the nurses to hand you your baby, and especially if gentle cesareans are offered. If you can't hold your baby, perhaps your partner can. If your baby has to be whisked away to the NICU or the nursery, don't let it get you down. This is standard in some hospitals after a C-section and is more likely to indicate a precaution than a problem. And as far as bonding is concerned, later can be just as good as sooner. So not to worry if the snuggles have to wait a little while.
Tying your tubes after delivery. Thinking about ending your baby-making career after this delivery and contemplating a permanent solution to birth control? Though it's far easier for dads to take this step, vasectomy, the male version of sterilization, is much less invasive, moms choosing to have their tubes tied can opt to add the procedure to their birth plans. Whether you're delivering vaginally or via C-section, having a tubal ligation right after your baby's birth definitely saves time and money and will certainly make postpartum sex, when you finally get around to it, more convenient. If you've delivered via cesarean, since an incision has already been made to get your baby out and you're already numb from the anesthesia, there's little extra fuss or muss involved. Your doctor will simply clip or clamp your fallopian tubes before stitching your incision back up. If you've delivered vaginally, the doctor will make a small incision under the belly button. The benefit to doing the procedure right after delivery is that your uterus is still large, so there's easy access to your fallopian tubes. Most doctors will perform a tubal ligation right after a vaginal birth, only if mom has received an epidural during labor and it's still in place. You likely won't need any extra recovery time or experience any extra pain from the procedure, beyond what you'd experience anyway after delivery. And if you did, it would be hard to differentiate one pain from the other. You probably also won't need any additional pain medication, again, beyond what you might take for postpartum pain. Vaginal seeding after cesarean delivery. Babies born vaginally pass through and come out covered with lots of bacteria-filled vaginal fluid. Studies show that these vaginal microbes are beneficial, helping to shape a newborn's immune system and possibly even reducing the risk of immune diseases like asthma later in life. But babies born via cesarean delivery don't make the trip down the birth canal and consequently miss out on those natural vaginal microbes. What C-section babies do get exposed to are skin microbes, which some research suggests puts babies at higher risk for metabolic and immune disorders. And that's why the practice of vaginal seeding, when doctors or midwives swab a mom's vagina and wipe those fluids on her newborn's mouth, nose, face, and body after a cesarean delivery, has become a trend these days. But experts, including ACOG, warn that there is insufficient data to show that vaginal seeding, also known as microbirthing, is beneficial. In fact, the one study suggesting a benefit to the practice was conducted with only 4 babies. What's more, and more risky, is that there's also a significant chance the practice can cause harm to the baby by increasing the risk of infections, which is why vaginal seeding isn't recommended and why you should cross it off your birth plan wish list. Want your cesarean-delivered baby to reap mom-provided yet safe immune benefits? There's no better way than through breastfeeding, since colostrum and breast milk pass important antibody-building nutrients to your little one at every feeding. Chapter 15. Expecting Multiples.
Have 2 or more passengers aboard the mothership? Then chances are you have at least double the joy and excitement, and at least double the questions. Will the babies be healthy? Will I be healthy? Am I more likely to have complications? Will I be able to stick with my regular practitioner? Or will I have to see a specialist? How much food will I have to eat? And how much weight do I have to gain? Will there be enough room inside of me for 2 babies? Will I be able to carry them to term? Will I have to go on bed rest? Will giving birth be twice as hard? Carrying 1 baby comes with its share of challenges and changes. Carrying more than 1, well, you've probably already done the math. But not to worry. You're up for it, or at least you will be once you're armed with the information in this chapter and the support of your partner and your practitioner. So sit back comfortably while you still can and get ready for your amazing multiple pregnancy. If you'd like to see any of the illustrations from this chapter, you can download and print out a special PDF from the same Audible page where you purchase your audiobook.
What you may be wondering about, carrying more than 1.
Choosing a practitioner.
We just found out we're having twins. Can I use my regular OB or do I need to see a specialist?
Having twins is definitely special, but it doesn't definitely require a specialist care. Just make sure you really like your regular OB before you commit. Since twin pregnancies always come with more office visits, you'll be seeing a lot of each other. Do you like your OB but also like the idea of extra careful care? Many general OB practices send patients who are pregnant with multiples to a specialist for periodic consultations or refer them to a specialist later in pregnancy or at any point if things take a turn for the complicated. A good compromise if you'd like to combine the familiar comfort of your OB's care with the expertise of a specialist. Moms-to-be of multiples who have other risk factors, they're older, have a history of miscarriage, or have a chronic health condition, may want to start off with or consider switching over full-time to a maternal-fetal medicine specialist, also known as a perinatologist. Talk that possibility over with your OB if your pregnancy falls into a higher risk category. If you're carrying triplets or more, your best bet is to get your prenatal care from a perinatologist right from the beginning. When choosing a practitioner for your multiple pregnancy, likely a physician since most midwives don't offer care for multiple pregnancies, you'll also want to factor in hospital affiliation. Ideally, you'll want to deliver at a facility with the ability to care for premature babies, one with a NICU, in case your bundles arrive early, as multiples often do. Also ask about the doctor's policy on topics specifically related to multiple births. Will you be induced at 37 or 38 weeks as a matter of course? Or will you have the option of carrying beyond that time frame if all is going well? Will a vaginal birth be possible under certain circumstances, or at least a trial of labor? Or does this doctor routinely schedule moms of twins for C-sections? Will you be able to deliver vaginally in a birthing room? Or is it routine to deliver multiples in an operating room?
Midwife care for multiples? Even if your regular practitioner is a midwife, it's possible that you'll be able to stick with her, at least for part of your pregnancy, as long as it stays low risk, and assuming her credentials, license, and experience allow her to care for and deliver twin pregnancies. Unfortunately, many midwives don't meet that set of criteria, which means that while it's possible you'll find one who can care for and deliver twin pregnancies, it's more likely that you won't. While some midwives will provide prenatal care for low-risk twin pregnancies, others will care for a mom of twins only up to a certain gestational age, and others won't take a twin pregnancy on at all due to the potential of it turning high risk. What's more, some states don't allow midwives to care for or deliver multiples, and many birthing centers won't allow twin deliveries either. But that doesn't mean you have to write off midwife care entirely. Midwives who have collaborative agreements with OBs who can act as backups in case of complications are more likely to agree to signing up a mom of twins. And even if your care does need to be transferred to an OB or a perinatologist at some point, your midwife may be able to stay involved in your pregnancy and even attend your birth. Have your heart set on a home birth? You may have a hard time finding a midwife who will deliver twins at home, especially if you live in a rural area where an OB and hospital backup may be too far away. If you do decide to use a midwife for your prenatal care, at least initially, and especially if you choose to have her or him deliver your babies, be sure to choose someone who has plenty of experience managing twin pregnancies.
Pregnancy symptoms.
I've heard that pregnancy symptoms are way worse when you're having multiples. Is that true?
Twice the babies sometimes spell twice or more the pregnancy discomforts, but not always. Every multiple pregnancy, like every singleton pregnancy, is different. An expectant mom of one may suffer enough morning sickness for two, while a mom-to-be of multiples might sail through her pregnancy without a single queasy day. The same with other symptoms, too. But though you shouldn't expect a double dose of morning sickness or heartburn or leg cramps or varicose veins, you can't count it out. The miseries do, on average, multiply in a multiple pregnancy, and that's not surprising given the extra weight you'll be carrying around and the extra hormones you're already generating. Among the symptoms that might be, but won't necessarily be, exponentially exacerbated when you're expecting twins or more, morning sickness. Nausea and vomiting can be worse in a multiple pregnancy, thanks to, among other things, the higher levels of hormones circulating in a mom's system. Morning sickness can also start earlier and last longer, and severe nausea and vomiting, hyperemesis gravidarum, is more common among moms-to-be of multiples. Other tummy troubles. More gastric crowding and more gastric overloading, since moms of multiples are eating for three or more, can lead to an increase in the kinds of digestive discomforts pregnancy's known for, like heartburn, indigestion, and constipation. Fatigue. This is a no-brainer. The more weight you're dragging around, the more you're likely to drag. Fatigue can also increase with the extra energy an expectant mom of multiples expends. Your body has to work twice as hard to grow two babies. Sleep deprivation can also wear you out. It's difficult enough to settle down with a watermelon-sized belly, let alone one that's the size of two watermelons. And speaking of no-brainers, expecting twins can thicken the normal brain fog of pregnancy. All those other physical discomforts. Every pregnancy comes with its share of aches and pains. Your twin pregnancy might just come with a little more than its share. Toting that extra baby can translate to extra backache, hip pain, pelvic twinges, pelvic and round ligament pain, crampiness, swollen ankles, varicose veins, you name it. Breathing for a crowd can also seem to be an extra effort, especially as your uterus full of babies gets big enough to crowd out your lungs. Fetal movement. Though every pregnant woman might feel at some point that she's expecting an octopus, the eight limbs you'll be carrying will really pack a punch. Make that many punches and kicks. Whether your multiple pregnancy ends up doubling up on discomforts or not, one thing's for sure. It'll also gift you with twice the rewards. Not bad for 9 months' work.
Seeing double everywhere? If it looks like multiples are multiplying these days, it's because they are. In fact, nearly 4% of babies in the United States are now born in sets of two, three, or more, with the majority, about 95% of these multiple births, composed of twins. At least twice as amazing, the number of twin births has jumped more than 50% in recent years. Rates of higher-order multiples, triplets, and more, are starting to decline, but are still up about 300%. So what's up with this multiple baby boom? While identical twins usually happen by chance, your chance of having fraternal twins, the more common type of twin, increases based on the following factors, some of which can also influence the odds of having higher order fraternal multiples too. Age. The older you are, the higher your odds of having fraternal twins. Moms over the age of 35 are naturally more likely to drop more than one egg at ovulation, thanks to often higher levels of FSH, or follicle-stimulating hormone, upping the odds of having twins. Fertility treatments. As techniques in assisted fertility become more sophisticated, they're less likely to produce multiples, especially higher-order multiples. Still, having any kind of fertility treatments, particularly the kind that stimulates ovulation or implants more than one embryo, multiplies the chances of a multiple pregnancy. Obesity. Women who are obese when they conceive with a BMI higher than 30 are significantly more likely to have fraternal twins than women with lower BMIs. Size. There is some evidence that larger, taller women may be slightly more likely to conceive twins than smaller women, but the connection appears weak, meaning size doesn't matter much. Race. Twins are slightly more common among African Americans and somewhat less common among Hispanics and Asians. Family history. Do fraternal twins run in your family? Or are you a fraternal twin yourself? Your chances of having multiples are greater than average. And if you've already had a set of fraternal twins, you're twice as likely to have another set in a future pregnancy. Now that's a win-win-win-win.
Eating well with multiples.
I'm committed to eating well now that I'm pregnant with triplets, but I'm not sure what that means. Eating three times as much?
Belly up to the buffet table, Mom. Feeding four means it's always time to chow down. While you won't literally have to quadruple your daily intake any more than a woman who's expecting a single baby has to double it, you will need to do some serious eating in the months to come. Moms-to-be of multiples should cash in on an extra 150 to 300 calories a day per fetus, doctor's orders. Good news if you're looking for a license to eat, not so good news if queasiness or tummy crowding has your appetite cramped, which translates to an extra 300 to 600 calories if you're carrying twins, an extra 450 to 900 calories for triplets, if you've started out with an average pre-pregnancy weight. But before you take that extra allotment as a free pass to Burritoville, extra guacamole for baby A, extra sour cream for baby B, extra refried beans for baby C, consider this. The quality of what you eat will be just as important as the quantity. In fact, good nutrition during a multiple pregnancy has an even greater impact on baby birth weight than it does during a singleton pregnancy. So just how do you eat well when you're expecting more than one? Check out the pregnancy diet and keep it small. The bigger your belly gets, the smaller you'll want your meals to stay. Not only will grazing on five or six healthy mini meals and snacks ease your digestive overload, but it'll keep your energy up while delivering the same nutritional bottom line as three squares. As space gets even tighter, you may even want to eat even less, even more often, and you'll probably want to keep some nibbles bedside in case you get hungry during the night. Make your calories count. Pick foods that pack plenty of nutrients into small servings. Studies show that a higher calorie diet that's also high in nutrients significantly improves your chances of having healthy, full-term babies. Wasting too much of that premium space on junk food means you'll have less room for the nutritious food your crew of cuties needs. Go for extra nutrients. Not surprisingly, your need for nutrients multiplies with each baby, which means you'll have to tack on some extra servings to your daily dozen. It's usually recommended that moms of multiples get one extra serving of protein, one extra serving of calcium, and one extra serving of whole grains. Be sure to ask your practitioner for specific recommendations in your case. Pump up the iron. Another nutrient you'll need to ramp up is iron, which helps your body manufacture red blood cells. You'll need lots of those for the increased blood your multiple baby factory will be using, and helps keep you from becoming anemic, which often happens in multiple pregnancies. So eat up from the list of iron-rich foods. Your prenatal vitamin and possibly a separate iron supplement should fill in the rest, but ask your practitioner for specifics. Keep the water flowing. Dehydration can lead to preterm labor, something moms-to-be of multiples are already at risk for, so drink up. For more information on eating well for multiples, check out What to Expect, Eating Well When You're Expecting. Weight gain.
I know I'm supposed to gain more weight with twins, but just how much more?
Get ready to gain. Experts advise a normal weight woman expecting twins to gain between 37 and 54 pounds. Why the big spread? Because recommendations differ considerably based on your particular profile and your practitioner's recommendations. Carrying triplets? Since there are no official guidelines, you'll need to check in with your practitioner for a specific target weight gain total, which will likely exceed 50 pounds, a little less if you were overweight pre-pregnancy, a little more if you were underweight. Sounds like a piece of cake, right? Or maybe two pieces of cake. Or hey, maybe the whole cake. But the reality is, gaining enough weight isn't always as easy as it seems when you've got two or more on board. In fact, a variety of challenges you may face throughout your pregnancy can keep the numbers on the scale from climbing fast enough. Standing between you and weight gain in the first trimester might be nausea, which can make it difficult to get food down and then keep it down. Eating tiny amounts of comforting and hopefully sometimes nutritious food throughout the day can help get you through those probably queasy months. Aim for a pound a week gain through the first trimester, but if you find you can't gain that much or have trouble gaining any at all, relax. You can have fun catching up later. Just be sure to take your prenatal vitamin and stay hydrated. Use the second trimester, which will probably be your most comfortable and the easiest for you to do some serious chowing down in, as your chance to load up on the nutrients your babies need to grow. If you didn't gain any weight during the first trimester, or if you lost weight due to severe nausea and vomiting, your practitioner may want you to gain an average of 1.5 to 2 pounds per week, starting now. If you've been gaining steadily through the first trimester, you can aim a bit lower. Either way, that may seem like a lot of weight in a short time, and you're right, it is. But it's weight that's important to gain. Supercharge your eating plan with extra servings of protein, calcium, and whole grains. Indigestion and heartburn starting to cramp your eating style? Spread your nutrients out over those 6 or more mini meals. As you head into the home stretch, the third trimester, you'll still need to continue your steady rate of gain. By 32 weeks, your babies may be 4 pounds each, which won't leave much room in your crowded out tummy for food. Still, even though you'll be feeling plenty bulky already, your babies will have to bulk up quite a bit more, and they'll appreciate the nutrition a healthy diet provides. So focus on quality over quantity and expect to taper down to a pound a week or less in the 8th month and just a pound or so total during the 9th. This makes more sense when you consider that most multiple pregnancies don't make it to 40 weeks.
What to gain when you're gaining for multiples. If your pregnancy status is normal weight with twins, your total weight gain should be 37 to 54 pounds. If it's overweight with twins, your total weight gain should be 31 to 50 pounds. If you're having triplets, you should ask your practitioner for recommendations.
exercise.
I'm a runner, but now that I'm pregnant with twins, is it safe to keep up my workouts?
Exercise can benefit most pregnancies, but when you're staying fit for three, you'll have to exercise care, too. First, check in with your doctor. Even if exercise is green-lighted during the first and second trimesters, your doctor will likely steer you toward more gentle options and away from any workout that puts downward pressure on your cervix, like running, or that raises your body temperature significantly. Running can do that, too. Most experts recommend that moms-to-be of multiples stay away from high-impact aerobic exercise, again, like running, after 20 weeks if any cervical shortening has been detected on ultrasound, because it increases the risk of preterm labor, and to stop running by 28 weeks even if there's no cervical shortening. Unfortunately, these guidelines hold true for experienced runners like you as well. Looking for a more appropriate fitness routine for the three of you? Good choices include swimming or pregnancy water aerobics, stretching, prenatal yoga, lightweight training, and riding a stationary bicycle, all exercises that don't require you to be on your feet while you do them. Though do ask your doctor if walking is safe in your case. It is most of the time. And don't forget your Kegels, the anywhere, anytime exercises designed to strengthen your pelvic floor, which needs extra reinforcement when there are extra babies inside. No matter what you're doing during your workout, if the exertion is causing Braxton Hicks contractions or raising any other red flags, stop immediately, rest, drink some water, and call your practitioner if they don't subside within 20 minutes or so.
Multiple timeline. Already counting down your 40 weeks? You might not have to count that many after all. A twin pregnancy is considered full term a full 2 weeks earlier at 38 weeks. Certainly reason to celebrate. 2 weeks less of puffiness, heartburn, and waiting. But just as most singletons fail to arrive on their due date, multiples keep their moms and dads and practitioners guessing too. They might just stay put until 38 weeks or longer, or they might make their appearance before they've clocked in, even a full 37 weeks. In fact, most do. If your babies do end up overstaying their 38-week term, your practitioner will likely elect to induce, taking into account how they're doing and how you're doing. ACOG's recommendation that low-risk twin pregnancies be delivered by the end of the 38th week may also be factored in, and that's one significant reason why few twin pregnancies are allowed to go longer than a full 38 weeks. Be sure to have an endgame discussion with your practitioner long before the end is near, because many differ on how they typically handle the late stages of a multiple pregnancy. Extra, extra! Not surprisingly, extra babies come with extra precautions, and that's a good thing. With extra precautions come extra excellent chances that your multiple babies will thrive and arrive safe, sound, and healthy. Here are some of the extras you can expect when you're expecting twins or more. Extra practitioner visits. Good prenatal care is the ticket to a healthy pregnancy and a healthy baby, at least doubly so when you're expecting multiples. So expect more frequent prenatal checkups. You'll likely be seen every 2 to 3 weeks, rather than every 4, up until your 7th month, and even more often after that. And those visits may get more in-depth as your pregnancy progresses. You'll get all the tests singleton moms get, but you may also get transvaginal ultrasounds to keep an eye on cervical length, to check for signs of preterm labor, as well as more non-stress tests and biophysical profiles in your 3rd trimester. You'll also likely be screened for gestational diabetes earlier and more often than a singleton mom would be. Extra pictures of your babies, that is. You'll get extra ultrasounds to monitor your babies and make sure their development and growth is on track, which means extra reassurance, plus extra peeks at that precious pair or trio, and extra pictures for your baby book or books. Extra close attention. Your practitioner will keep an extra close eye on your health to reduce your risk of certain pregnancy complications more common in multiple pregnancies. With all that extra attention, Any problem that develops will likely be caught and treated quickly.
Mixed feelings.
Everybody thinks it's so exciting that we're going to have twins, except us. We're scared and even disappointed. What's wrong with us?
Absolutely nothing. Prenatal daydreams don't usually include two babies. You prepare yourself psychologically, as well as physically and financially, for the arrival of one baby. And when you suddenly discover you're having two instead, feelings of disappointment aren't unusual. Neither is trepidation. The impending responsibilities of caring for a single infant are plenty daunting without having them doubled. Some expectant parents are happy to hear they're expecting multiples right from the start, but many others take some time getting used to the news. It's just as common to feel initial shock as initial joy, to feel you're being deprived of experiencing the cozy bond you'd always imagined with a single baby, but can't immediately see yourselves having with a pair. Guilt about questioning your double blessing, especially if becoming pregnant was a struggle to begin with, can compound your conflicted feelings. All of these feelings and the others you might be experiencing are a completely normal reaction to the news that your pregnancy and your lives are taking an unexpected turn. So accept the fact that you're ambivalent about the dual arrivals and don't saddle yourselves with guilt. Since your feelings are normal and understandable, there's absolutely nothing to feel guilty about. Instead, use the months before delivery to get used to the idea that you'll be having twins. You will. Talk openly and honestly to each other. The more you let your feelings out, the faster you'll work them through. Talk to anyone you know who has twins, and if you don't know any moms and dads of multiples, look to message boards. Sharing your feelings with others who felt them and recognizing that you're not the first expectant parents to experience them will help you accept and in time become excited about this pregnancy and the two beautiful babies you'll be holding one day soon. Twins, you'll find, may be double the effort at first, but they're also double the fun down the road.
Multiple connections. As a multiple's mother-to-be, you're about to join a special club already filled with thousands of women just like you. Women who are also expecting double the delight and, chances are, double the self-doubt. Never been a joiner? Membership in this particular club does come with plenty of rewards. By talking to other moms-to-be of multiples, you'll be able to share your joys, your fears, your symptoms, your funny stories, the ones nobody else would get, with those who know just how you're feeling. You'll also be able to score reassuring advice from other expectant moms who have multiples on the way, as well as from those who've already had their multi-stork delivery. Join a discussion group online. Check out whatToExpect.com for a multiples message board, or ask your practitioner to hook you up with other pregnant with multiples moms in his or her practice and start your own group. There are also national organizations that can provide you with contact information for local clubs, including the National Organization of Mothers of Twins Clubs, NOMOTC.org. Or you can use an online search engine to find a local multiples chapter. You can also check out online sites that cater specifically to parents of multiples, including mothersofmultiples.com and twinstuff.com.
Insensitive comments.
When I told my friend that we're having twins, she said to me, "Better you than me." Why would she make such a nasty comment?
That might be the first insensitive comment you've been ambushed by during your multiples pregnancy, but it probably won't be the last. From coworkers to family members to friends to those perfect, make that not so perfect strangers in the supermarket, you'll be amazed at the remarkably rude things people feel completely comfortable saying to an expectant mom of multiples. What's up with this lack of tact? The truth is many people don't know how to react to the news that you're carrying multiples. Sure, a simple congratulations might be in order, but most people assume that twins are special. They are, and therefore need to be recognized with a special comment. Curious about what it must be like to be pregnant with twins, in awe of what you'll be going through once they're born, they're clueless about the right response, so they dish out the wrong one. Their intentions are good, but their follow-through stinks. The best way to react? Don't take it personally, and don't take it too seriously. Realize that even as your friend opened her mouth and inserted her foot, she was almost certainly trying to wish you well, and she probably has no idea that she offended you, so try not to take offense. Remember, too, that you can be the best spokeswoman for moms of twins everywhere, and you'll have lots of chances to spread the wonderful word on multiples.
People keep asking me if twins run in my family or if I had fertility treatments. I'm not ashamed that I had IVF, but it's also not something I want to share with everyone.
A pregnant woman brings out the nosy like no one else, but a woman expecting multiples becomes everybody's business. Suddenly, your pregnancy goes public, with people you hardly know or don't know at all prying into your personal life and bedroom habits and prodding you for personal information without thinking twice. But that's just the point. These people really aren't thinking twice, or even once. They're not asking to be intrusive, they're just curious. Multiples are fascinating stuff after all, and they haven't been educated in twin etiquette. If you're open to sharing the details, then by all means, go for it. Well, first we tried Clomid, and then when that didn't work, we tried IVF, which means that my husband and I went to a fertility clinic. By the time you're halfway done with your story, the questioner will probably be bored to tears and looking for the nearest exit. Or you can try one of these responses the next time someone asks about the conception of your twins. They were a big surprise. This can be true whether you've conceived with or without fertility help. Twins run in the family. Now, this will shut them up while keeping them guessing. We had sex twice in one night. Who hasn't at some point? Even if the last time was on your honeymoon, it's not a lie, and it'll be the end of the line for their line of questioning. They were conceived with love. Well, that's a given no matter what, and where do they go from there? Why do you ask? If they're TTC trying to conceive themselves, then maybe it'll open up a conversation that could help them. Infertility can be a lonely road, as you probably know. If not, it could stop them in their nosy tracks. Not in the mood for a witty retort, or even to respond at all, especially after you've been asked the same question 5 times in a single day. There's nothing wrong with letting the questioner know that the answer is none of her business, which it isn't. That's a personal matter, says it all. Safety in numbers.
We'd barely adjusted to the fact that I was pregnant when we found out I'm carrying twins. Are there any extra risks for them or for me?
Extra babies do come with some extra risks, but not as many as you'd think. In fact, not all twin pregnancies are classified as high risk, though higher order multiples definitely fall into that category. And most expectant moms of multiples can expect to have relatively uneventful pregnancies, at least in terms of complications. Plus, entering your twin pregnancy armed with a little knowledge about the potential risks and complications can help you avoid many, and will prepare you should you encounter any. So relax, twin pregnancies are really safe. But listen up. For the babies, the potential risks include early delivery. Multiples tend to arrive earlier than singletons. More than half of twins, the majority of triplets, and practically all quadruplets are born preterm. While women pregnant with a single baby deliver on average at 39 weeks, twin delivery on average occurs at 35 to 36 weeks. Triplets usually come, again, on average, at 32 weeks, and quadruplets at 30 weeks. Keep in mind the term for twins is considered 38 weeks, not 40. After all, as cozy as it can be for your little ones in the uterus, it can also get pretty crowded as they grow. Be sure you know the signs of preterm labor, and don't hesitate to call your practitioner right away if you're experiencing any of them. Low birth weight. Since many multiple pregnancies end early, the average, repeat average, baby born of a multiple pregnancy arrives weighing 5.5 pounds, which is considered low birth weight. Most 5-pounders end up doing just fine health-wise, thanks to advances in caring for these small newborns. But babies born weighing less than 3 pounds are at increased risk for health complications as newborns, as well as for long-term disabilities. Making sure your prenatal health is in top-notch condition and your diet contains plenty of nutrients, including the right number of calories, can help get your babies to a bigger bottom line. See what to expect the first year for more on low birth weight babies. Twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, TTTS. This in utero condition, which happens in about 9 to 15% of identical twin pregnancies in which the placenta is shared, arises when one or more placental arteries from one twin deposits blood in the placenta that returns to the other twin through a placental vein. If there aren't any other common vessels present to equalize the delivery of blood to both fetuses, the result can be one baby getting too much blood and the other too little. Fraternal twins are almost never affected because they never share a placenta. This condition is dangerous for the babies, though not to the mom. If it's detected in your pregnancy, your practitioner will likely refer you to a perinatologist who may suggest laser therapy of the placenta, using a special device placed in the uterus, to stop the transfusion. Alternatively, although less effective, the physician may opt to use amniocentesis to drain off extra amniotic fluid every week or two, which improves blood flow in the placenta and reduces the risk of preterm labor. If you're dealing with TTTS, check out fetalhope.org for more information and resources. Other complications. There are other fetal complications that are more likely to occur in a multiple pregnancy, but that are still uncommon. Ask your practitioner about other additional risks for your babies and how you can best modify them. A multiple pregnancy can also impact the health of the mother-to-be. Preeclampsia. The more babies you're carrying, the more placenta you've got on board. This extra placenta, along with the added hormones that come with two babies, can lead to high blood pressure and sometimes to preeclampsia. Preeclampsia affects 1 in 4 mothers of twins and is usually caught early, thanks to careful monitoring. Gestational diabetes. Expectant multiple moms are slightly more likely to have GD than singleton moms. That's probably because higher hormone levels can interfere with a mom's ability to process insulin. Diet can usually control or even prevent GD, but sometimes extra insulin is needed. Placental problems. Women pregnant with multiples are at a somewhat higher risk for complications such as placenta previa, aka low-lying placenta, or placental abruption, aka premature separation of the placenta. Fortunately, careful monitoring, which you'll be getting, can detect placenta previa long before it poses any significant risk. Placental abruption can't be detected before it happens, but because your pregnancy is being carefully watched, steps can be taken to avoid further complications if an abruption occurs.
Pregnancy reduction. Sometimes an ultrasound reveals that one or more of the fetuses in a multiple pregnancy can't survive or is so severely malformed that the chances of survival outside the womb are minimal, and worse yet, that the unhealthy fetus may be endangering your other healthy one or ones. Or there are so many fetuses that there is a significant risk to the mother and all her babies. In such cases, your practitioner may recommend a pregnancy reduction. Contemplating this procedure can be agonizing. It may seem like sacrificing one baby to protect another, and may leave you plagued with guilt, confusion, and conflicted feelings. You may come to your decision of whether to proceed or not proceed easily, or it may be an excruciating decision-making process. There may be no easy answers, and there are definitely no perfect options, but you'll want to do whatever you can to make peace with the decision you end up making. Review the situation with your practitioner and seek a second opinion, or third, or fourth, until you're as confident as you can be about your choice. You can also ask your practitioner to put you in touch with someone from the bioethics staff of the hospital, if that's available. You may want to share your feelings with close friends, or you may want to keep this personal decision private. If religion plays an important role in your life, you'll probably want to look to spiritual guidance. Once you make your decision, try not to second guess. Accept that it's the best decision you can make under the difficult circumstances. Also, try not to burden yourself with guilt, no matter what you choose, because none of this is your fault. There's no reason to feel guilty about it. If you end up undergoing pregnancy reduction, you may expect to experience the same grief as any parent who has lost one or more babies.
Bed rest.
Will I have to be on bed rest just because I'm carrying twins?
To bed rest or not to bed rest, that is the question many moms-to-be of multiples ask, and practitioners don't always have an easy answer. That's because there really isn't an easy answer. The obstetrical jury is still out on whether bed rest helps prevent the kinds of complications sometimes associated with a multiple pregnancy, such as preterm labor and preeclampsia. And even though most research shows there's no benefit, many practitioners continue to prescribe some version of bed rest, especially under certain circumstances. For example, if mom's cervix is shortened, or she has high blood pressure, or if one or both of the babies isn't growing well. Since the risk of complications increases with each additional baby, bed rest is even more likely to be prescribed in higher order multiple pregnancies. Be sure to have a discussion with your practitioner early in your pregnancy about his or her philosophy on bed rest. Some practitioners prescribe it routinely for all expectant moms of multiples, often beginning between 24 and 28 weeks, while most do it on a case-by-case basis, taking a wait-and-see approach. And keep in mind that even if you aren't sent to bed, your practitioner will probably still advise you to take it easy, cut back on or stop work, and stay off your feet as much as possible during the latter half of your pregnancy. So get ready to rest up anyway. Vanishing twin syndrome.
I've heard of vanishing twin syndrome. What is it?
Detecting multiple pregnancies early using ultrasound technology has many benefits, because the sooner you and your practitioner discover you've got two or more babies to care for, the better care you'll be able to get. But there's sometimes a downside to knowing so soon. Identifying twin pregnancies earlier than ever also reveals losses that went undetected before the days of early ultrasound. The loss of a twin during pregnancy can occur in the first trimester, often before a mom even knows she's carrying twins, or less commonly, later in pregnancy. During a first trimester loss, the tissue of the miscarried twin is usually reabsorbed by the mother's body. This phenomenon, called vanishing twin syndrome, occurs in about 20 to 30% of multiple pregnancies. Documentation of vanishing twin syndrome has grown significantly over the past few decades, as early ultrasounds, the only way to be sure early in pregnancy that you're carrying twins, have become routine and are used even earlier and more often in an IVF pregnancy. Researchers report more cases of vanishing twin syndrome in women older than 30, though that may be because older moms in general have higher rates of multiple pregnancies, especially with the use of fertility treatments. There are rarely any symptoms when the early loss of a twin occurs, though some women experience mild cramping, bleeding, or pelvic pain, similar to a miscarriage, though none of those symptoms is a sure sign of such a loss. Decreasing, not disappearing hormone levels, as detected by blood tests, may also indicate that one fetus has been lost. The good news is that when vanishing twin syndrome occurs in the first trimester, a mom usually goes on to experience a normal pregnancy and delivers the single healthy baby without complication or intervention. In the much less likely case that a twin dies in the second or third trimester, the remaining baby may be at an increased risk of intrauterine growth restriction, and the mother may be at risk of preterm labor, infection, or bleeding. The remaining baby would then be watched carefully, and the rest of the pregnancy monitored for complications.
All about multiple childbirth.
Every delivery day is an unforgettable one, but if you're carrying twins or more, yours probably won't be the typical birth story you've heard from moms who've delivered just one. Not surprisingly, things can get a little more complicated when you've got two babies or more heading for the exit, and a lot more interesting. Will your labor and delivery be twice the effort? What will be the ideal way to deliver your multiple newborns into your arms? The answers can depend on a lot of factors, such as fetal position, your health, the safety of the babies, and so on. Multiple births have more variables and more surprises than single births. But since you'll be getting two or more for the price of one labor, your multiple childbirth will be a pretty good deal no matter how it ends up playing out. And remember that whatever route your babies take from your snug womb to your even snugger embrace, the best way is the one that's healthiest and safest for them and for you. Laboring with twins or more. How will your labor differ from the labor of a mother of one? Here are a few ways. It could be shorter. Will you have to endure double the pain to end up cuddling double the pleasure? No. In fact, when it comes to labor, you're likely to catch a really nice break. The labor is often shorter with multiples, which means that if you'll be delivering vaginally, it may take less time to get to the point where you can start pushing. The catch? You'll be hitting the harder part of labor sooner. Or it could be longer. Because a multiple's mom's uterus is overstretched, contractions are sometimes weaker, and weaker contractions could mean that it might take longer to become fully dilated. It'll be watched more closely. Because your medical team will have to be twice as careful during your multiple delivery, you'll be monitored more during labor than most moms of singletons. Throughout labor, if you're delivering in a hospital, the most common scenario, you'll likely be attached to two or more fetal monitors so your doctor can see how each baby is responding to your contractions. Early on, the baby's heartbeats may be monitored with external belt monitors. This could allow you to go off the monitors periodically so you can walk around or hit the whirlpool tub, if you're so inclined. In the latter stages of labor, baby A, the one closest to the exit, may be monitored internally with a scalp electrode, while baby B is still monitored externally. This will put an end to your mobility because you'll be tethered to a machine. If you're delivering at home with a midwife, your babies will be monitored with a Doppler more frequently. You'll probably have an epidural, again, assuming you're delivering in a hospital. If you've had your heart set on one anyway, you'll be happy to hear that epidurals are strongly encouraged or even required with multiple deliveries in case an emergency C-section becomes necessary to deliver one or all of your babies. If you'd like to avoid an epidural, talk to your practitioner ahead of time. You'll probably deliver in an operating room. Chances are you'll be able to labor in a comfy birthing room, but when it's time to push, you'll be wheeled into the OR. Most hospitals require this just to be on the safe side and in case an emergency C-section becomes necessary, so ask ahead. Delivering twins. Here's what you can expect when delivering your twins. Vaginal delivery. About half of all twins born these days come into the world vaginally. But that doesn't mean the birthing experience